Thank you, Lauren, for your kind words of introduction. I'm very pleased to be here, and I would like to thank Professor Mark Weller for inviting me to come and speak to you this afternoon. This center is one of the foremost centers of international law anywhere in the world. Yesterday we had the pleasure of honoring Sir Elie Lauterpacht at Gorazien, and I'm pleased to be back here at the center, which he was so instrumental in establishing. The topic for my presentation this afternoon is reassessing and redefining the principle of economic sovereignty of states. What do we mean by this principle? How it has been interpreted, and has the time come to revisit this concept? These are the three issues that I will be addressing this afternoon. In spite of a massive growth in international environmental law and international economic law, in the past 60 or so years, there still are not any specific international treaties regulating the exploitation of certain natural resources such as oil, gas, minerals, and land by individual states. Nor are there any global treaties regulating the activities of multinational or large national companies which are engaged in the exploitation of such natural resources. The law has not moved, in my opinion, very far from the 1972 Stockholm Declaration on the human environment or the 1974 Charter of Economic Rights and Duties of States. With regard to the regulation or conservation of natural resources located entirely within the national borders of the states concerned, especially with regard to those natural resources which are non-renewable. There is no clear requirement in international at the moment on individual states to ration the exploitation of non-renewable natural resources, either in interest of the future generation or the environment. For instance, no member states of the OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, feels under any obligation to ration the production of oil in the interest of the environment or future generations. Similarly, unlike in some other areas of international law, such as international human rights law, there are some international mechanisms to monitor the internal human rights situation in a given country. There is no mechanism to monitor the internal economic activities of a state which pollute the environment or cause other forms of harm. Nor is there an international reporting mechanism of major development projects carried out by individual states which enables the international community to assess the level of harm caused to the environment by such projects and recommend adoption of mitigating measures or change in behavior. Most states do not have a mechanism for an environmental impact assessment or other forms of impact assessment of major development projects. But in the absence of an international mechanism to monitor the effective application or implementation of such an assessment, this tool doesn't seem to be effective in preventing governments from causing harm to the environment while carrying out their developmental activities. Thus, no states feel restrained in any way from mining its mineral resources, even when carrying out its ambitious national policy of natural resource exploitation. Many oil and mineral rich countries are undergoing a massive transformation in terms of their infrastructure with little regard for the environment. The same is true with regard to many large developing countries, which are in the process of a massive industrialization. In the exploitation of their natural resources and in industrializing their country or economy, such countries are transforming the landscape of parts of the earth within their control, sometimes beyond recognition. Economic development is being pursued at a huge cost to the environment, both local and global. However, the law, as it stands today, neither restrains states from such activities nor requires them to contribute financially to the improvement of the global environment. These states have invoked the principle of economic sovereignty of states to shield themselves from international scrutiny of their activities. Of course, the law does prescribe certain rules in this regard, but these are limited to the exploitation of certain shared natural resources or the activities that they are likely to have transboundary impact. It should be noted that most polluting activities that states carry out are related to the exploitation of natural resources located within their own national borders. The legal basis upon which such unrestricted rights are claimed and exercised by states is the principle of economic sovereignty of states. It is in this context that I aim to examine the current issues surrounding the application and invocation of this principle and explore whether the time has come to reassess and redefine the meaning and scope of this principle in order to position it in a broader context of international law. What's the basis of economic sovereignty of the states? The notion of economic sovereignty flows from the notion of a sovereignty itself and the notion of economic self-determination of states. The main international legal instruments which support economic sovereignty are the Charter of the United Nations itself, the 1962 UN Declaration on the Permanent Sovereignty of States over their Natural Resources and Wealth, the 1974 Charter of Economic Rights and Duties of States, 1986 United Nations Declaration on the Right to Development, and the 1992 Rio Declaration on Environment and Development. However, until recently, the element of sustainable economic development or the need to conserve the natural resources of the earth were missing in the body of international economic law. Whether it was oil or water or phosphates or gas, all natural resources of a state have been regarded as commercial commodities to be exploited for the economic development of the country concerned. As such, there is a history of optimal utilization of natural resources by states for economic development. Even the attempts made in the 1960s and 70s within the United Nations to define the nature of the legal relationship between a host state and a foreign company on the issue of expropriation did not seek to regulate the unhindered exploitation of natural resources by the states themselves. With the exception of a resolution of the United Nations adopted in 1962, designed to endorse a call for UNESCO to enact effective domestic legislation to preserve natural resources, including flora and fauna, the emphasis was very much on establishing in international law the right of states to exploit their natural resources in accordance with their own developmental policies. So the law so far has been to strengthen the rights of states to exploit their natural resources to the maximum capacity possible. Not only various international economic law instruments, but also various human rights instruments adopted in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s sought to establish and strengthen the rights of states and peoples to freely dispose of their wealth and natural resources. Even the resolutions of the United Nations concerning the new international economic order and the Charter of Economic Rights and Duties of States adopted in the mid-70s did not introduce the element of sustainability or considerations for the environment while engaging in the exploitation of the natural resources of the country concerned. Thus, traditionally speaking, the idea of sustainable development or the need to conserve natural resources was missing in the main corpus of international economic law. It was only through developments taking place elsewhere, mainly in the area of international environmental law, that the idea of a sustainable economic development and the need to conserve natural resources was introduced into the agenda of international economic law. Now, the shift in paradigm that has taken place over the last 20 years, I would like to say a few words about that one. The 1990s, as we all know, began with the promise of the creation of a new world order after the end of the Cold War in Europe, at least. But that promise turned out to be an unfulfilled one. Thus, the 21st century began with a quest for a balanced system which paid due attention to human rights considerations and environmental concerns while seeking to further the international economic agenda. Some of the elements of the new international economic order from the 1970s seem to be resurfacing to give shape to the new agenda for the new century, that is this century. Ideas such as the quota-free and a duty-free access to world markets for the products from the least developed countries, special and preferential treatment for developing countries, and some relaxation of the provisions in the agreement on the protection of intellectual property rights in favor of developing countries, especially with regard to medicines for public health in these countries, came to be part of this international agenda. The world seemed to be witnessing a shift in emphasis in terms of the regulation of international economic relations. The future progress in this quest for a balanced system seemed dependent on the negotiating positions of different groups of countries on certain fundamental issues such as the liberalization of trade in agriculture, regulation of foreign investment, the balance between environmental protection and a trade liberalization, and the inclusion or exclusion of labor rights and other human rights issues within the international trade agenda. The quest for a balanced international economic order was not confined to trade matters within the framework of the WTO, World Trade Organization. The Millennium Declaration of the United Nations, adopted in 2000, also included provisions designed to achieve economic equality and reduce world poverty. Attempts were also made at the 2002 Monterrey Conference on Financing for Development to help the developing world to reduce poverty. In any list of major international efforts to establish new order for the 21st century, one would also include the Second Earth Summit, officially entitled the World Summit on Sustainable Development, held in Johannesburg in 2002. Although the World Summit was designed mainly to address environmental problems facing the world at the beginning of the new century, it did also address the economic problems of the world, and the Global South indeed sought to ensure that a great deal of emphasis was placed on their economic development, mainly sustainable development. Thus, the efforts made towards the end of the 20th century and the beginning of the 21st century do represent, in my opinion, a turning point in the evolution of international economic law. This period marks the beginning of a new phase characterized by an effort to reconcile international economic activities with the tenets of sustainable development. In other words, it was a period during which both economic and environmental policies were converging to give a shape to a new world order. Although the 1992 Rio Conference had introduced the principle of sustainable development as a new policy in the economic development of the world, the concern for the environment had still not fully been integrated with these economic policies. The outcomes of the World Summit, together with the Millennium Declaration, the 2001 Doha Declaration, and Monterrey Consensus, all sought to integrate both economic and environmental policies into a single policy with clear linkages among the four principal pillars of the New World Order. And the principal pillars, in my opinion, of this New World Order are as follows. Number one, free trade. Number two, sustainable development. Number three, poverty alleviation. And number four, democratic governance. These all are coming together to give a shape to a new world order within international law. One may disagree as to how much, or perhaps more accurately, how little has been done towards achieving such goals, but their place in the global economy is increasingly settled. Now, economic sovereignty within this context. The principle of economic sovereignty was developed, as many of you would know, mainly after the establishment of the United Nations, and especially after the independence of many developing countries, to enable these countries to develop their economy. But this very principle is now invoked by these very states to engage in unrestricted economic activities at the expense of the environment and often human rights and other societal and human values. Indeed, many of the countries which are engaged in massive industrialization and other forms of exploitation of natural resources are not necessarily genuine democracies, and have thus no credible internal mechanism to scrutinize governmental decisions and policy. Some forms of planning permission or environmental impact assessment or other human impact assessment exist in some countries, introduced by the World Bank and many other regional development banks. But these mechanisms do not play much of a role in countries where no dissension or opposition to governmental policy or decision is possible. Just as the states have come to accept the notion of limited political sovereignty thanks to the development and existence of international human rights norms, new norms of economic development could be introduced to restrain states from carrying out activities within their own national borders, which are likely to produce significant detrimental impact on the global environment and the interests of the future generation. If the protection of the natural heritage located in other countries can be the subject of protection through international regulation, due to their global significance, the exploitation of huge deposits of natural resources, such as petroleum products and other mineral resources, located in the countries concerned could also be brought under some form of international regulation. Of course, the principle of sustainable development and a number of other international environmental law principles, such as the precautionary principle, intergenerational and intragenerational equity, the duty to protect biodiversity, including the marine environment, the duty to make equitable utilization of shared natural resources, including international watercourses, and the duty to refrain from causing significant harm to other states, already impose certain limitations on the economic sovereignty of the states. However, these obligations and restrictions are vague and general in nature. The time has come for international law to flesh out these principles and prescribe some concrete rules in this regard. The nature, scope, and meaning of the notion of economic sovereignty itself should be revisited. How should it be revisited then? The following would be my ideas. While some international treaties can impose obligations on states, others empower them. Much of international law that has been enacted over the last 60 years or so has been designed to empower states rather than impose restraints on states, especially after the independence of many developing countries in Asia and Africa. Even international economic law, the notion of economic sovereignty of states, designed to empower states rather than regulate the activities of states, rather than restrain states to act in the interest of a broader societal values. One of the principal ways that this occurs is to strengthen states' economic sovereignty. International law thus has to go beyond the traditional framework and provide guidelines on how to exploit natural resources located within the national borders of states. Perhaps the time has come for international law to impose certain direct restrictions on states with regard to their activities to exploit their natural resources. Some of the things I have outlined before are indirect restrictions, but the time has come perhaps to impose some direct restrictions on states. For instance, some sort of a mechanism for international scrutiny of major developmental projects of individual states, which are likely to have a significant detrimental impact on the environment, both local and global, could be introduced. Similarly, states which benefit hugely from the exploitation of the natural resources by polluting the environment could be required to set aside a certain percentage of their proceeds to a global fund to address the global environmental problems. Some of the provisions in the Convention on the Law of the Sea of 1982, for instance, already provide some models in this direction. For instance, coastal states which have landlocked states as their neighbors are required to set aside some of the fisheries resources in their exclusive economic zone for exploitation by the landlocked states in the region. And in the provisions concerning the mining of the resources of the deep sea bed, some of the proceeds generated from the deep sea bed mining must be contributed to a fund designed to be distributed to developing countries. The idea behind the adoption of such mechanism was that some of the proceeds generated from the exploitation of the global commons should be shared among all the peoples inhabiting the planet Earth. Similarly, the proposal that could be made is that it would be fair to require those countries which benefit from the exploitation of the natural resources of the planet Earth to contribute to a fund designed to protect and preserve the common good, including the environment of the planet Earth. Similarly, the time has come for international law to put in place certain mechanisms to monitor the economic development activities of states to ensure that they do not cause significant harm to the environment. If the United Nations Human Rights Council can appoint special rapporteurs like me, I'm the United Nations Special Rapporteur for Cambodia, to monitor the human rights situation in a given country, there is no reason why Similar special rapporteurs for the protection of the environment or sustainable development could not be appointed to monitor the pollution or other forms of harm to the environment by the activities of governments. Moreover, there is already a mechanism within the World Bank, the inspection panel, for instance, and within most regional development banks to entertain applications alleging breaches of the operational policies of the banks concerned by the governments in carrying out their developmental activities financed by such banks. This model could be developed for a wider application through an international legal instrument designed to protect the environment globally. Neither international economic law nor the notion of economic sovereignty of the states is static. They are evolving concepts and have to be interpreted in a manner which is conducive to protecting and promoting the common objectives of humanity, namely the protection of the global environment and strengthening economic justice for both the present and future generations. Thank you for your attention.